From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, our weekly drop-in at the UN headquarters in New York begins with a press conference from the Secretary General's spokesperson, Farhan Haq.
Good afternoon, everyone. Rosemary DiCarlo, the Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, told the Security Council this morning that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict continues to be locked in a dangerous paralysis that is fueling extremism and exacerbating tensions in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. She warned that there is a growing risk of more unilateral actions and the loss of hope that peace can be achieved through negotiations. Ms. DiCarlo noted the demolition of housing in Sur Bahir by Israeli authorities yesterday, resulting in the displacement of 24 Palestinians, including 14 children, while the livelihoods of some 300 people were affected. As Deputy Special Coordinator Jamie McGoldrick stated yesterday, Israel's policy of destroying Palestinian property is not compatible with its obligations under international humanitarian law and contributes to the rise of forcible transfer facing many Palestinians in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Ms. DiCarlo briefed the Security Council on Gaza, saying that the UN continues to work closely with Egypt to mediate and de-escalate tensions there. While our joint efforts are beginning to bear fruit, she said that she remains deeply concerned by the humanitarian, economic, and political situation there. The shortage of medicines, equipment, and personnel continue to impede the ability of health providers to meet the needs of patients, including those severely injured, during the weekly protests at the perimeter fence. And the EU6 will speak about the Middle East at the Security Council stakeout at around 12:30. In a statement we issued yesterday afternoon, the Secretary General said that he was deeply saddened to learn of the passing of Mr. Yukiya Amano, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Through his stewardship of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Director General Amano worked tirelessly to ensure that nuclear energy is used only for peaceful purposes. In leading IAEA in such an exemplary fashion, he advanced human well-being through efforts spanning medicine, agriculture, and other vital areas. Mr. Amano confronted serious global challenges, including those related to the proliferation of nuclear weapons, with equanimity and determination. Our world, the Secretary General said, is so much better for it. The full statement is online. The Undersecretary General for Peace Operations, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, is traveling today to Cyprus. He will be there until the 26th of July to meet with the leaders of the two communities on the island, as well as civil society and community representatives. Mr. Lacroix will meet with the special representative of the Secretary General in Cyprus, Elizabeth Spehar, and personnel of the UN peacekeeping mission. He will also visit key locations where the UN mission is deployed along the buffer zone. Following discussions with European states in Paris, yesterday, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, and the Director General of the International Organization for Migration, Antonio Vitorino, welcomed the consensus on the need for action on Libya and the Mediterranean. Violence in Tripoli in the past few weeks has made the situation more desperate than ever, and the need for action is critical, they said. The heads of UNHCR and IOM stressed the importance of ending the arbitrary detention of refugees and migrants in Libya. They added that no one should be returned to detention centers in Libya after being intercepted or rescued at sea. Mr. Grandi and Mr. Vitorino also acknowledged the renewed commitment from states to prevent loss of life on the Mediterranean Sea. They called for a European Union state search and rescue operation, adding that the status quo, where search and rescue operations are often left to NGOs or commercial vessels, cannot continue. Finally, they urged states to work with their agencies to get the most vulnerable refugees in Libya out of danger and welcomed expressions of support in this regard that they heard in Paris. More information is available online. The Deputy Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Syria Crisis, Mark Cutts, expressed concern on the mounting civilian casualties in the Idlib area after one of the deadliest attacks on civilian areas in the past 3 months took place yesterday. In the attack, at least 66 civilians were killed, and over 100 women, children, and men were wounded in scores of airstrikes and shelling incidents in multiple locations across the northwest. The worst attack was an airstrike on a popular public market in Marat al-Numan. which left at least 39 dead, including 8 women and 5 children. Many more were injured, some seriously, and the casualty count is expected to rise further in the coming days. Since the end of April, the UN has documented over 400 civilian deaths in total. The UN reminds all parties to the conflict and those who have influence over them of their obligation to protect civilians and the principles of distinction and proportionality enshrined in international humanitarian law. The UN calls for the September 2018 Memorandum of Understanding on Idlib to be upheld. The UN also calls for attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure to come to an end and for areas to be made accessible for humanitarian assistance. Our humanitarian colleagues tell us that the crisis in northeast Nigeria, now in its 10th year, is showing no signs of abating. More than 7 million people are in need of life-saving assistance, including nearly 3 million people who are food insecure. Some 1.8 million people are internally displaced, and this number is rising due to the continued violent clashes between non-state armed groups and Nigerian security forces. Despite the insecurity, the United Nations and humanitarian organizations have reached more than 2 million people with aid. The 2019 Humanitarian Response Plan for Nigeria seeks $848 million to help 6.2 million people, but it's only 33% funded. Beyond Nigeria, the Boko Haram insurgency is also affecting Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, with nearly 10 million people in need of humanitarian assistance across the Lake Chad region. This year, the humanitarian community is seeking $1.3 billion for the Lake Chad region, but the appeal is only 20% funded so far. The World Food Program is working with the government of Bangladesh to help more than 275,000 people affected by flooding in the country's northwest. An innovative project which uses weather forecasts to trigger early actions such as cash transfers is being used for the first time. Some 5,000 households, or 25,000 of the most vulnerable people, have received money through mobile transfers as part of the project. The government of Bangladesh says that more than 2 million people have been affected in nearly one-third of Bangladesh's 64 districts. WFP is closely monitoring the situation and stands ready to assist further. Our colleagues at the UN Global Compact today announced that 28 companies with a combined market cap of $1.3 trillion have committed to step up their climate action ahead of the Secretary General's Climate Action Summit in September. These companies collectively represent over 1 million employees from 17 sectors and more than 16 countries and include Unilever, Levi Strauss & Company, Vodafone, and Hewlett-Packard, among others. The companies have committed themselves to more ambitious climate targets, aligned with limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and reaching net zero emissions by no later than 2050. You can find the full list of companies online. And in a short while, I'll be joined by UNAIDS Executive Director ad interim Gunilla Carlson. She'll brief on the UNAIDS Global AIDS Update and the report on implementation of the Declaration of Commitment on HIV/AIDS. And after that, we will hear from Monica Villela-Grayley. Are there any questions for me first? Yes, please.
Farhan, some questions following the meeting that's still ongoing on the Middle East. Does the Secretary General believe that the UN Security Council's resolutions are binding international law?
It's a clear point of principle that Security Council resolutions count as binding international law.
So does he believe that the resolutions passed by the Security Council on Israel-Palestine are binding on all the parties and are pretty clear?
I know where you're trying to lead with that, but the basic point is that we've always called on all member states to abide by all Security Council resolutions, and we do so in this circumstance as well as others. We're aware of the nature of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and the challenges that has arisen from it over the decades. But at the same time, yes, we do still call on all countries to respect the resolutions
of
the Council.
So does the Secretary General agree with the U.S. Special Representative Jason Greenblatt, who says the resolutions are a tricky subject that could be discussed for years, or instead with the German ambassador, who suggests the U.S. is treating those binding resolutions as an a la carte menu?
I'm not going to get into the war of words between different individuals on this. It's clear that the Council's resolutions need to be respected. Enforcement of the resolutions is, as you know, up to the members of the Security Council themselves. Yes, please, Abdul Hamid.
Thank you. In her remarks, Rosemary DiCarlo said that the UN condemned all attacks on civilians, both Israelis and Palestinians. Does that include the settlers? Are the settlers who live on the land they confiscated, carry guns and protected by the Israeli army, are they considered civilians? Clear cut, I want an answer, yes or no. Are the settlers are just completely 100% civilian or not?
She has made it clear that we regard all attacks on people who are not armed, who are not carrying arms, as acts that are deplorable and need to be avoided.
But
Yes,
settlements are illegal. Those who live in the settlements are living in land they don't belong to. It's not theirs. They took it by force. Are they civilians?
You're well aware of where the UN stands on settlements, and we are against the principle of the settlements. At the same time, unarmed people are civilians, and they should not be attacked. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Farhan, yesterday, in a meeting with President Trump, with Pakistani Prime Minister, President Trump said that he's willing to be a mediator between Pakistan and India on Kashmir, which India immediately said no. But given the fact that it is still a international issue, which about does the Secretary General believe there is a time that he can go and mediate on the issue, because Kashmiris are still suffering from the occupation of the Indian troops? So where does the Secretary General stand now?
Well, our good offices are always available, as the Secretary General himself has made clear. Ultimately, what's needed for any such effort to be successful is that both parties need to be willing to reach out to the UN or to any other party for any such mediation.
The thing is, the good offices are being offered by the Secretary General. One side says yes, other side says no. He says we were going to discuss it bilaterally. So where does the United Nations can, at any point in time, one of the parties which is unwilling to talk, to bring it to the table also?
It's a simple fact that the successful operation of any mediation effort requires the willing participation of both sides. Yes.
Thank you, Farhan. Yesterday, you read Secretary General expressed concern and asked for restraint with regard to the seizure of vessels in the Persian Gulf. The UK Foreign Minister proposed in the Parliament the creating of a maritime force for the safety of especially Strait of Hormuz. Where does Secretary General stand on this? And has he been in touch with any of the parties, UK and Iran, with regard to the seizure of the vessels recently?
The UN has been in touch with the parties at various levels. On this, I'll just repeat what we've said, that the Secretary General wants all parties to exercise restraint and to avoid any actions that could escalate the situation.
And the creation of the maritime force.
I'm aware that these discussions are ongoing, but ultimately the important thing is for all nations to take steps to de-escalate tensions. Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you two Palestinian-Israeli related questions in the Secretary General's position. The first is, does the Secretary General have a position, and if so, what it would be, regarding the Palestinian Authority's criminalization of the voluntary sale by a Palestinian to an Israeli Jew of dwellings in Jerusalem? So that's the first question. The second question is, does the Secretary General have a position, if so, what would it be, regarding the Palestinian Authority's decision to continue paying terrorists families or imprisoned terrorists, suspected terrorists themselves, stipends at the expense of the welfare of the Palestinian people?
On that, I would just refer you to the briefings, including the one by Ms. DiCarlo today in terms of where we stand on what we feel are the appropriate actions.
Well, she did not answer that. So I'm asking whether the Secretary General has an explicit opinion on the appropriateness of making those payments to alleged terrorists and their surviving families at the expense of the welfare of the Palestinian people. She did not answer that question.
I believe the Palestinian Authority themselves have dealt with questions about where the money is going. But we have talked in the past about what the responsible activities of the Palestinian Authority are.
I had the first question about the sale, voluntary sale by a Palestinian to an Israeli Jew of a dwelling in Jerusalem, the criminalization of that by the Palestinian Authority. What is the Secretary General's opinion on that?
I'm not going to get into different authorities' legal systems. Ultimately, those are issues to be worked out by the legal authorities with respect for due process. Yes, Abdelhamid.
Yes, again, back to the destruction of homes in Sur Bahir and leaving so many civilians homeless and uprooted from their homes, and some of them became refugees for a second time, as it has been said in the briefing. So such an incident with that magnitude doesn't really merit a statement from the Secretary General himself rather than from his associates in the field?
As I mentioned yesterday, the Secretary General fully supports the statement that was issued in the region.
Why he didn't himself issue a statement to show, to give some weight to this incident?
As he himself made clear, he fully supports that statement. That should give it some weight, yes.
The Secretary General has repeatedly said that he'd like to see steps to de-escalate tensions in the Gulf. And we're not really clear what he is proposing with regard to that. So there is a new development, and I'd like to see whether he believes this is an escalation or a de-escalation. It's the proposal by the UK to have other of its allies come together and sort out some sort of military force in the Gulf, possibly to escort ships. Does the Secretary General see that as a step which will escalate or de-escalate tensions?
I think at this stage it's better to see how this discussion proceeds and whether it is, in fact, something that either gives rise to further tensions or not. I can't predict at this point what that will do. We do know that the situation a few weeks ago was certainly a calmer one, and that is what we're trying to return to. How we get from here to there, we'll leave it to the nations to resolve. But we're hopeful that all the countries in the region and elsewhere are aware of what the responsibilities are and the need to keep freedom of navigation protected in the Strait of Hormuz and throughout.
And given this proposal for this force, does the Secretary General believe such a proposal requires some sort of UN mandate, for example, from the Security Council?
Again, I don't want to get into this at this stage while it's still something that's being discussed by different governments. Let's see what the content of those discussions yields. Yes. Mr. Abadi.
Thank you, Farhan. The Secretary General is always opposed to the use of violence. And we see the use of resort to violence in Hong Kong. Does he have any reaction to these events? And does he have any plans or ideas on how to resolve the issue?
I don't have anything new to say about the situation there. You've heard what we've said in past weeks on this. Yes.
Thank you, Juan. Two different questions. One is about climate change. Today, United Nations issued the Clean Air Initiative in preparation for climate summit during this General Assembly. Why now such an initiative issued by UN? And the second question is different. It's about Mozambique, hit by a heavy cyclone this March and April. And one of the UN officials, according to the local paper, UN officials is very much concerned about the prevailing of the terrorism after the affected area. especially the human trafficking, and to hire the children to the soldiers. How serious does Secretary General see the situation after the cyclone hit in Mozambique?
Yes. Well, for your second question, you're referring to something that an official from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime was discussing. And obviously, this shows the need to be able to rebuild the lives of the Mozambicans whose lives were shattered by the two cyclones, Idai and Kenneth, that you need to have a reconstruction not just of buildings, but of the sort of economic livelihood that could keep people away from illicit activities. And that will be an important step as we move forward. And one of the reasons why we need, as the Secretary General made clear in his recent visit, continued international support, including financial support, for the people of Mozambique. And regarding the Clean Air Initiative, as you'll see, there will be a number of initiatives being proposed, including as we head towards the climate summit, and we're hoping that member states will come to support all of them. We'll only have time for a couple more questions before we get to our guest. Yes.
I'm going to change the subject to Cyprus. In the upcoming discussions that you referenced in your briefing, is it anticipated that Mr. Lacroix will bring up the subject of the Turkish exploration off the coast of Cyprus for oil and gas reserves? And secondly, will he bring up the subject of the influx over the years of settlers from Turkey into northern Cyprus and the legality of such settlements?
Well, I'm not going to speak out in advance of the meetings he's having. He will have meetings with various parties while he's in Cyprus, and of course, as I mentioned, he will meet with the head of the mission there, Elizabeth Spehar, and discuss a wide range of issues. We can give more details about those meetings after they've happened. Yes.
I asked you a question a few days ago about the child who was shot in the head in Deir Kaddoum. His name is Abdulrahman Shtewi. He's 10 years old. He was shot directly in the head. You said you will come back to me with a certain language. Yes.
Yes. Yes. The Office of the Special Coordinator is looking into this. When we have something to say on it, I'll let you know. And with that, let me get to our guest. Thanks very much. And we're very pleased to have with us today the Executive Director ad interim of UNAIDS, Gunilla Carlson. Ms. Carlson, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here today to talk with you about a few things that are happening at UNAIDS, the joint program for HIV/AIDS in the United Nations. We had our program coordinating board meeting in June, and we had several important items on the agenda. I had the opportunity to brief the board on the importance of partnerships and of galvanizing political leadership to reach the 2020 FAST targets. I also talked about UNAIDS Management Action Plan, which we have established to ensure that UNAIDS Secretariat is a healthy, equitable, and enabling workplace for all staff. The board welcomed the actions taken to date by the UNAIDS Secretariat and the many still planned to eliminate all forms of harassment from our workplace and develop a fully enabling workplace environment. The board was also presented with a shortlist of candidates for the position of Executive Director of UNAIDS and heard from the chair of the search committee who introduced the committee's report. The chair of the board has now sent the report to the committee of co-sponsoring organizations led by UNFPA Dr. Natalia Kanem, which will make its recommendation to the United Nations Secretary General. The UN Secretary General will make the final decision about the appointment of the new Executive Director of UNAIDS. We look forward to welcoming the new Executive Director of UNAIDS in the foreseeable future. We have also launched a new global report, and I would like to say that we are at a precarious point in the response to HIV. Some countries are making impressive gains, while others are experiencing rises in new HIV infections and even AIDS-related deaths. annual gains are getting smaller and the pace of progress is slowing down. UNAIDS report shows that key global AIDS targets for 2020 are unlikely to be met, even though some countries and regions have made good progress. Globally, there are now over 23 million people on treatment, surviving, thriving, and living healthy lives, and that's good news. But globally, 15 million people are still waiting for treatment, either not being tested or being tested and not having access to treatment and care yet. New infections are not declining fast enough. We are seeing continuing rises in new infections and AIDS-related death in Eastern Europe and Central Asia and in the Middle East and Northern Africa. Men are not still being reached as widely as women, and children are not getting access to treatment. Only half of all children living with HIV had access to treatment in 2018. Key populations, which now makes up to 54% of the new HIV infections, are still not being reached. And we are talking about sex workers, people who use drugs, men who have sex with men, transgender people, prisoners, and their partners. Add to this, ladies and gentlemen, that available resources last in 2018 had fallen by almost $1 billion, and there is a finance gap of $7 billion at date. The data in this year's report is deeply concerning. It shows that ending AIDS will not be possible unless we are investing adequately and smartly, focus on people first, not diseases, and that we create roadmaps for people and locations still being left behind. We have to take a human rights-based approach to reaching the people most affected by HIV. The world is far off the target of increasing the number of new infections to 500,000 by 2020. In 2018, there were 1.7 million new infections. Reaching this target means that over the next 18 months, we must reduce new infections by 70%, and that never happened before. HIV infections are preventable and treatable, yet we must reinvigorate the goal of zero new infections if the HIV response is to be sustainable. We need a strong commitment from political leaders everywhere to end stigma and discrimination that prevent people accessing essential life-saving services. We cannot end AIDS without ending stigma and discrimination associated with HIV. The UNAIDS Global Report clearly shows that communities can drive change, and that's why we had that as a theme for this global update. Communities are the eyes, ears and the hearts of the AIDS response, and they play a very critical role in holding decision makers to account and demanding political leadership. A common lesson learned in all parts of the world is that community approaches to the AIDS response deliver results. The more we invest in communities, the closer we get to ending AIDS. The ways forward, as we see it, is that we need courageous political leadership to inspire the end of this epidemic, and that every country needs to put AIDS higher on the agenda, invest adequately and smartly, and build the capacity of civil society and primary health care. To deliver non-discriminatory human rights-based and people-centered HIV services at the head of the communities most affected by HIV is to deliver smartly. And I don't underestimate the scale of challenges, but I do believe the end of AIDS is possible. This will, however, require increased political leadership and a renewed global commitment to end AIDS as part of the Sustainable Development Goals. This brings me to the upcoming ECOSOC resolution on UNAIDS, the draft resolution which member states will debate and adopt on the 24th of July here in New York, is a clear and strong member state support on the continued leadership role in the response of UNAIDS. It reaffirms UNAIDS' pivotal role in galvanizing and supporting the AIDS response as part of the SDGs and stresses the need for UNAIDS to continue providing the critical support.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.